This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 182 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Of course, I'm going to open this week's mailbag show with some talk around the two-point conversion conversation. If you didn't see it on Monday night, the Giants were down by 14, and they scored a touchdown. After doing so, they opted to go for a two-point try instead of kicking the extra point. So they were down 8, and they didn't care to be down 7. They went for 2. And everyone lost their minds, especially when that 2-point try failed. If you don't quite understand the logic behind going for 2, that's totally fine. But there's a lot of smart and really pretty basic math that goes into it. The main point that I think a lot of people have missed with the whole debate is that there seems to be this assumption that forcing overtime means a team wins. If we assume the Giants would score twice and kick the extra point after both touchdowns to force overtime, that's obviously not the case. Hypothetically, they'd still only have a 50-50 shot to win. Meanwhile, when you go for two, you're creating an opportunity to win in regulation. And when you go for two on the first touchdown instead of the second touchdown, you're able to make up for a failure. A lot of people were saying, well, why not kick the extra point first and then go for two at the end of the game? And the reason is because if you miss the two-point conversion then at the end of the game is over. If you miss the first two-point conversion, you have another two-point try on the second touchdown to force overtime. Essentially, going for two in that situation is optimal from a probability standpoint. The math really, really favors it. I'm less concerned about people not fully understanding the strategy because it's not something we've been used to seeing. It's hard to wrap your head around why going for two in that situation is actually mathematically sound. I totally get it. I'm more annoyed by the pushback from people who actually didn't dig into the reasoning. It's one thing to not get it, it's another to trash the decision based on absolutely nothing. You had Booger McFarland tweet this after the game, quote, "I'll say it again, to hell with analytics when your defense is busting their ass to keep you in the game and you score and you go for two because of percentages. Bad coaching decision by Pat Shurmur." First off, I've got nothing against Booger as a human because I've never met the dude. I'm sure he's a good guy. But what does that tweet even mean? What does that mean? It's not like a failed two-point try means that the game is over. It's still a one-score game. Meanwhile, the expected point value on a two-point conversion isn't that far off from an extra point anyway. In fact, in 2018, kickers are converting 94.8% of their extra point tries. That means you would expect to score 0.948 points on a random extra point. 35 of the 59 two-point tries this year have succeeded. That's a crazy 59.3% success rate. Since you're getting 2 points instead of 1 point in a two-point conversion, the expected point value in 2018 on a two-point try has actually been far higher than an extra point. It's been 1.19 versus 0.948. Now, historically, these numbers have been much closer. But in 2018 specifically, teams actually should be going for two more than they are. You may then say, but it's the Giants. They suck offensively. Well, the Giants have faced 6 third and two plays this year, and they've converted 5 of those plays. They've had 5 third and three plays, and they've converted 4 of those. The main point here is that an extra point versus a two-point try isn't giving you a tremendous advantage in expected value to begin with. You could actually make the argument that going for two consistently makes more sense, but that does depend a lot on game situation. But in this game situation, going for two mathematically makes a ton of sense. And yet, you've got talking heads telling you that Pat Shurmur was wrong, and that math can't help explain the mindset of a defense. Just stop. Just freaking stop. This is not a moment of analytics have no part in football. We're talking about a simple decision as to whether or not you should go for two. Not whether you should throw an end zone fade versus running a draw. Like, if you can't accept that this is the absolute type of scenario where math should play a role in football, then you're never going to want math to play a role in football. And that's fine if you feel that way. I think it's silly, but you're more than welcome to have that opinion. Just don't fire off your tweet by saying, "I get the math, but," or "we should utilize analytics, but." Fortunately, a lot of smart teams are making decisions like this. We saw the Eagles set a record for going for it on fourth down last year, and Doug Peterson actually did this exact same thing earlier in the year. He went for two earlier this year when the Eagles were down 8. This just shouldn't be debated the way it's being debated. Mathematical logic shouldn't be thrown out the window because it's football. We shouldn't ignore intelligent information because football. And if we should, let's hear why. Give us a real reason why, backed with evidence that's not anecdotal or results-based. because I would love to hear it. We do have some great questions on today's mailbag show, but before digging in, I wanted to remind you guys about the weekly exclusive FanDuel free play that we've got going on for NumberFire Podcast Network listeners. In last week's NumberFire free roll, DF Superstar took home the top prize with a score of 181.78. They had Marlon Mack and paired him with Todd Gurley, Tariq Cohen, Trey Burton, and John Brown. A very, very nice lineup. You can join this week's free play where you can win FanDuel points and NumberFire premium subscriptions by going to FanDuel.com/league/Brandon. That's FanDuel.com/league/Brandon. This first question is from @Tampa2Tone. Is it time to adopt the zero RB approach even in leagues that only force you to start two wide receivers in a flex? No, I don't think so. I talked about zero RB on a mailbag episode about a month or so ago, and how I think it's weird that we're seeing people take victory laps because Leonard Fournette and Dalvin Cook and others are sidelined with injury. But meanwhile, Todd Gurley is single-handedly carrying fantasy squads. Ezekiel Elliott has mostly been pretty good. Saquon Barkley and Kareem Hunt are both strong RB1s, especially Barkley. And then Kamara and Melvin Gordon have been really good too. My stance is the same, and it'll probably continue to be the same. Elite running backs give you the biggest advantage in fantasy football. And generally, the only way to obtain those players is by drafting them early. That's generally why I take a modified zero RB approach most of the time when I get an early round running back, especially if I have a top pick, and then I pound wide receivers. I want a shot at one of those massive edges. So no, I don't think it's time to adopt zero RB in every league. There's nothing wrong with zero RB and it can absolutely work, but I don't think it's right to look at this season and think that it's automatically a great zero RB year when the best running backs in football were all drafted really early in August. This next question is from @MrTrabTweets. Is Elijah McGuire worth a stash, eligible to return to the Jets in week 9? Absolutely. The offense he's in isn't necessarily the best one for fantasy production, but the team was talking him up a bit before his injury this offseason, and now there's obviously no Bilal Powell. And Powell this year has a 41% rushing share with an 8% target share. So if he's on your waiver wire, go ahead and grab him. Any running back who's in line for potential work should be added. And you never know when you're going to get that second half of the season breakout like we saw last year with Kenyon Drake. This next question is from @DominiColisi. With Kerryon as a rising asset in Detroit, will Stafford not have to throw as much as previous years? Since week 2, Stafford's attempts have gone down from 53 to 36, 30, 26, and now 22. Curious if there's a correlation between the two. I think the biggest relationship here is that the Lions have been able to jump out to leads and see positive game scripts more than anything else. If you look back at their first two games, they were both losses where Stafford combined to throw 99 passes. So since week 2, like you mentioned, they've been 3-1 with their only loss being a 2.1 to Dallas that likes to run at a slow pace, and they could have easily won that game. It's not really shocking that Stafford has thrown fewer attempts. The Lions are running 63 plays per game this year when they ran 61.3 per game last year. They've been more run-heavy from a ratio standpoint, though. Last year's pass-to-run was 1.57, and it was 1.88 when in neutral game scripts. This year, their overall ratio has dropped by 0.1, and their neutral script ratio by about 0.3. But like I said, there have been some funky outings where they've gotten off to these fast starts and taken leads. And the other thing to remember is that pass attempts don't technically correlate to fantasy success on a week-to-week basis at the quarterback position. I know this is counterintuitive, but when you set a baseline at 20 attempts per game, it mathematically doesn't matter whether a player throws 20 or 50 times. I do think there may be a point in which it does start to matter, but the overall R-squared of pass attempts to fantasy points scored is like 0.02. It's non-existent. And the main reason for that is because touchdowns drive fantasy football, especially at the quarterback position. I mean, we saw it with Andrew Luck last week. He throws for 156 yards on 23 attempts, but he had 4 touchdowns, so it didn't matter. And then there's rushing for some of those lower volume passers as well. So back to the question, do I think there's a correlation between Kerryon Johnson becoming a stud and Matthew Stafford throwing it fewer times? Well, I think more volume is pushed to the run game when teams are leading, and the Lions have been leading a lot since week 2. In fact, since that time, they've only run 35 plays while trailing, which is the fewest in football. So if that continues, then sure, he won't throw as many attempts as he has in previous seasons. But Detroit also has contests against the Seahawks, the Vikings, the Bears twice, the Panthers, and the Rams over their next 6 games, and those contests will not be easy. So I'm not sure that they're going to have the leads that they've had. And that'll mean more than 25 pass attempts for Matthew Stafford. This next question is from @DreamAssembler. My league mates and I are frustrated when good fantasy teams are hurt by randomness of scheduling. great teams are frequently beaten by worse teams with the one random high-scoring anomaly. We want to help reward good teams for their production, so do you have any ideas? Thanks. Yeah, I do have some ideas. The format I use in my home league for the playoffs is as follows. You have two divisions where the top two from each division make the playoffs. The top teams from each division then get a bye. The fifth spot in the playoffs is then given to the best record that's not in of those four teams. And it doesn't matter which division they belong to. And then the sixth spot goes to the team with the most points that's not in. So that rewards the team who might have gotten screwed over a bit by a rough schedule. Now, before you guys sit there and say, why not just make it a points league, or why have divisions anyway? It's mostly because it creates a lot of good rivalry and smack talk. I also try to make all the divisional games across the second half of the season to try to make things really interesting down the stretch. But if you want to do away with divisions, go for it. I also commission a dynasty league where there are no divisions, the top five records get in, and then the sixth spot is for the most points that's not in. There are also league formats where you play two games each week, one against your opponent and one against the league's average score. Apex Fantasy Leagues hosts those types of formats. And then you could also have a weekly prize for the top scorer of the week. So I hope those ideas help you. This next one sort of relates to the previous one. It's from @GiantMeatball. I keep losing really close games, twice by 0.4, once by 1.8. My points for and points against are both average. Should I be concerned? Should I be looking to trade depth away for very high quality starters? I mean, I'm a fan of always trading depth for better starters, so to answer that question, yes. But you really should evaluate your team by looking at how consistent it's been, and then looking at how many points you've scored. If you're average, then you should probably have an average record. You may want to make some upgrades. If you have the second most points in your league, but you're 2-5, then you can probably stay put because you're just getting unlucky. And then the opposite is true as well. This next question is from @TheUSOfArsenal. What is your methodology for evaluating bench spots when considering waiver moves, trades, and weekly buys? It's pretty simple, really. I ask myself if I'm ever actually going to use a particular player and if he has a reasonable shot of ever being in my lineup. If the answer is no, then he's going to be the first player that I drop. I also try to make sure my opponent wouldn't benefit from that player, so I sometimes wait until the end of the week to drop him in order to ensure that opponent can't use him. When you ask those questions, though, you're really saying, am I good to go at this position, all while asking, is this player actually a good fantasy asset? And you'd be surprised at how much more efficient your bench then becomes when you answer those questions honestly. This next question is from @CDCarter69. Where do you value Aaron Jones going forward? He's in the pile of higher-end RB3s with upside, but I would argue that he still has more upside than the majority of those guys. The Packers, to me, haven't been rational with his usage, and he deserves more touches, but that's irrelevant. If he's not going to get the ball, he's not going to be fantasy relevant. But someone as talented as he is, who's in a really good offense, should absolutely be rostered. If the Packers ever decide to feature him, or if Jamal Williams goes down, then he's going to be a huge value. So for some names that I'd rather have Aaron Jones over, how about Ito Smith, probably both Eagles running backs at this point, Royce Freeman, Carlos Hyde, those types of players. This last question is from @Tubaca_. Amari Cooper forecast? Scott Linehan has always fed his wide receiver one, ... I talked about Amari a bit on my 15 Transactions podcast earlier this week, and my biggest problem with him is that the Cowboys want to be a run-heavy team, and they run at a slow pace. I worry about volume in that offense. And to your point about Scott Linehan always feeding his wide receiver ones, as is the case with most offensive coordinator data, we've got to give that some context. Linehan has been the offensive coordinator for Minnesota back in 2002 to 2004, then Miami for a year, then he was the head coach in St. Louis from 2006 to 2008, then he was the offensive coordinator for Detroit from 2009 to 2013, and then he's been in Dallas since 2014. When he was in Minnesota, he had Randy Moss. In St. Louis, he had Torrey Holt. In Detroit, he had Calvin Johnson. And then in Dallas, he had Dez Bryant. The only sort of outlier we have with Scott Linehan feeding his top receiver was Chris Chambers seeing 166 targets for Miami in 2005. But he also saw 154 targets the following year. But if this is a true trend, then why aren't we seeing a player be fed in this year's offense? I'm only bringing this up because it's something that I talked about over the offseason. Offensive coordinator data can be really impactful, but talent is far more important than anything. Good players get targeted. Amari Cooper might be a really good player. We've seen flashes of him being very good. But if he ends up getting fed, it's because of that, not because of Scott Linehan. So my take on Amari is that he's probably more of a wide receiver three type with upside. I also don't fully trust a wide receiver changing teams mid-season in an offense that's not very pass-friendly. It's not like we're talking Josh Gordon with Tom Brady. We're talking a run-first team with Dak Prescott. So I'm hoping for the best with Amari Cooper, but I'm trying to be realistic and don't think his ceiling is all that high. That's going to do it for today's mailbag show, though. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And make sure you're following me on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate you. Enjoy your weekend, and good luck in Week 8.